Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. Our topic tonight is heroin and harm reduction. Recent reports show that the number of people who use heroin in the U.S. has doubled over the past decade. Yearly drug overdose deaths are also skyrocketing, more than triple the amount in 1990, attributable to bad heroin and to people turning to heroin because it's cheaper and easier to get than the popular prescription drugs Oxycontin and Vicodin. What are some of the new forms of dangerous heroin showing up in the Bay Area and beyond? What are some of the key policy and advocacy efforts underway in California and nationwide? How has San Francisco, a national leader in providing services based on the philosophy of harm reduction, been serving the needs of its residents? Joining me in studio to discuss these issues and more are Laura Thomas, the Deputy State Director of the Drug Policy Alliance, where she oversees the organization's Model City Initiative for San Francisco. Laura has 25 years of experience in HIV and public health policy and has worked for Tenderloin Health and Continuum HIV Day Services and for the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you.
Johnny Lorenz is the Needle Exchange Manager and Support Group Facilitator for the San Francisco Drug Users Union. He left the hardcore punk scene in Washington, D.C. 25 years ago, cleaned up his act, and has been working with fellow drug users ever since in different capacities that include the State Parolee Treatment Program and at San Francisco General Hospital. Welcome, Johnny.
Thank you.
And Daniel Ciccaroni is a professor of clinical family and community medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. He is both an MD and has a master's in public health. He has been providing community-based primary care in San Francisco for more than 20 years and is the lead or co-investigator on a number of research projects in the areas of public health, HIV/AIDS prevention, and heroin. Dr. Dan Ciccaroni, welcome to the program.
Thanks for inviting me.
And by phone, we have Dr. Alice Gleghorn, a clinical psychologist and the Community Programs Privacy Officer and County Alcohol and Drug Administrator for the San Francisco Department of Public Health Community Behavioral Health Services. Welcome, Alice.
Thanks for inviting me.
We invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by email at cityvisions@kalw.org, or you can post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page, and later in the program, we will open up our phone lines. Dr. Alice Gleghorn, we have you for a short while, so we're going to start with you. We really appreciate you being on the program. We know you're one of the most knowledgeable people about drugs and drug use in San Francisco. Can you give us a definition of harm reduction and its history in San Francisco public health?
Sure. Harm reduction is one of those terms that has gotten a bad name elsewhere in the country, but it is one of those things that San Francisco has embraced as our public policy since 2000. Essentially, people engage in behaviors that bring harm to them, and we support the idea that we need to look at ways to reduce the harm of the actions that people are taking. So San Francisco has been a leader in things like needle exchange programs and overdose prevention programs, providing substance abuse treatment on demand, et cetera, et cetera. So we have a lot of ways that we in San Francisco try and reduce the harms associated with substance use in San Francisco.
And what has been the reaction from both the public in San Francisco and around the country to the action San Francisco has taken in this regard?
Well, just to give a little historical perspective, early on, I've been with the health department for about over 18 years, and one of the early initiatives we worked on was something called treatment on demand, where the city around 1997 decided that they would use a rare budget surplus to really increase the availability of substance abuse treatment because people were wanting treatment, and there was no room in any of the programs. So San Francisco made a sustained monetary commitment to increase access to drug treatment programs for people who wanted treatment. And that had a cascading effect where we were able to pass the harm reduction resolution in 2000, dramatically increase the availability of treatment programs, provide comprehensive services. And one of the key outcomes that I think is informing the conversation tonight is that there was a heroin committee within the Treatment on Demand initiative, and that came up with a lot of the ideas for how we could prevent other harms to drug users that are still in programs today, including our development and funding of the Drug Overdose Prevention Education Program, called DOPE for short, which was one of the first places in California where we began educating drug users how to recognize signs of overdose, how to intervene in cases of overdose so that people didn't die, and that evolved then to distributing Narcan in 2003, and moving forward and distributing nasal-administered Narcan in 2010.
Can you explain for our listeners what that is and what that does to somebody who's overdosing?
Sure. Narcan is a safe and effective medication that acts to reverse the effect of an opiate overdose. So opiates, whether it's a heroin, a street drug, or a prescribed OxyContin or other opiate in pill form, they suppress the central nervous system, and someone doesn't die immediately of a drug being administered usually. It slows the system down, and eventually the individual stops breathing. Narcan operates by going to the same receptors where the opiate drug is sitting and knocks the opiate off of those receptors in the brain and immediately revives the individual, reverses the effect of the opiate. So when someone is turning blue, Narcan can be administered and they can be revived. So we started a pilot program in 2003 where drug users and their friends and partners that they use the drugs with were trained how to revive each other using an injectable form of Narcan. And the pilot program worked. Many people reported that they used the drug to reverse overdoses. So we expanded the program and did that for about 7 years, then came up with a form of Narcan that can be used as basically a nasal spray, an atomizer that's used up the nose rather than having to have needles in your hand to inject it. And we've really expanded our distribution of Narcan since 2010 because it's easier for people to use, and it's easier to reach out to family members and people who aren't as familiar with using needles and so forth.
And what do you say to the critics who would say, wait a minute, you are encouraging people to use more drugs because now they don't have to worry about overdosing because you've protected them from that, so they're going to be more irresponsible in their use? What is your response to critics who would make that point?
Well, you can ask any drug user who's ever experienced Narcan, and they will tell you it's not a pleasant experience. It does throw you immediately into withdrawal, and that's a very physically painful experience. However, they're not dead. And my response is that it's always better to save the life and help them another day than it is to go through the tragedy of losing another life.
And Alice, before we let you go, could you just let us know what trends you're seeing recently? Is there anything new that is particularly worrying you when you look at what is happening with heroin and similar drugs in San Francisco?
Well, there's been a lot more mixtures in the drug supply that we're seeing. So we've never had a terribly pure form of heroin, but we've always had kind of a dark sticky substance called black tar. Lately, the kind of samples that we're seeing brought in are different colored. They're sort of beige with a little bit of brown sticky substance in it. So what that tells us is there's a lot of mixtures going on there. And in fact, the recent death of Philip Seymour Hoffman, they reported that there was fentanyl. It's very difficult to know what you are getting when you are using a drug that's bought from a dealer on the street. You don't know, even though they're telling you, oh, this is good stuff, you don't know what's in it, and mistakes are easily made, and deaths happen quite easily because you don't know, you know, what's going to happen there.
Okay, well, we really appreciate you taking a few moments to be with us this evening, and we will take the conversation from here, but thank you so much for being on the phone with us this evening.
Sure, thank you.
Dan, I'd like to follow up with you directly from that. Well, before we even go into the recent trends, you've done a lot of research on this topic. For our listeners who might have some idea in their mind of what heroin is, what types of people use it, what it does with them, can you just give kind of a heroin 101 for our listeners?
So heroin is useful for pain management. It's useful. Folks use it to get high with. It can be, depending on which form it is, it can be smoked. It can be snorted, inhaled up the nose. It could be injected. What's interesting is that we tend to lump it together as one. What's interesting to me is we tend to lump it together as one substance. It's actually, depending on its source, a variety of different products. And each of these different types of heroines, these source types, if you will, are used differently. And here's where my research interests come into play, and that is I'm very interested in how each source type is used and the different medical consequences that stem from that. So, for example, Dr. Gleghorn brought up the idea of black tar heroin. It tends to come from Mexico. It's a solid heroin. It's notorious for causing skin infections. It's also, and this is more speculation, and I've sort of published research on this, we believe that it's has a lower HIV potential because it's a solid heroin. It has to get heated to go into solution. It's a fussy heroin. It gums up syringes and makes them unusable so people can't reuse them. And we have shown some data that HIV is lower in the parts of the country where this solid black tar heroin exists.
And who are heroin users both in San Francisco and around the country?
You know, heroin users are, you know, like many people, they come in a very wide, diverse palette of humanity. There are folks that have come from being victims of injury and having pain, going to the physician, getting a prescription for opiate pain pills, and then finding themselves becoming highly dependent on that and perhaps migrating from that over to heroin. There are the youth who have experimented with a variety of things and find their way to the queen of all drugs, which is heroin. There's too many stories to tell. The story that's happening now is that there's a wave of folks that are coming from opiate pill dependency. We've had a decade or more of a pain pill epidemic going on in this country. And the reason why it's a problem is because we see folks in the ERs and in the hospitals with problems stemming from excessive use of pain pills. Well, the medical profession recognized this about 5 to 8 years ago and created a whole bunch of policy initiatives to change prescribing practices, to change how we use these wonderful pain pills, such that some people are getting cut off. And
so they were hooked, they were cut off, and they needed to look somewhere else.
Again, I don't want to get into sort of too much of a cliche, but to some degree, there's this trend now of highly dependent pain pill users migrating into the inner city streets looking for heroin. And we've documented this in some of my research, the stories of how people are finding their way to street heroin. The street heroin is cheaper, it's purer, it's more cost-effective, and they've already reduced the stigma, if you will, by being highly dependent on a legal drug. And so they find their way to the next best thing that's available on the street, which is heroin.
Johnny Lorenz, let me ask you about the San Francisco Drug Users Union, and tell me, who does your membership consist of? How do people find their ways to this union? What is this union, our listeners must be asking?
The San Francisco Drug Users Union is a group of men and women who identify as drug users, former and current drug users. We're founded based on there's drug user unions in Europe that have been around for over 30 years. And some of the oldest ones were in Germany. Another one that's very prominent in North America is VANDU in Vancouver, the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. Excuse me. And that's the basics of what our union is. And so we're a group of drug users who advocate for our fellow drug-using community.
And what kind of things do you advocate for?
We advocate for wider distribution of things like Narcan and Naloxone to prevent overdose deaths, the wider syringe exchange, needle exchange, having it as available as possible for people. We even advocate for the decriminalization of drugs and drug use. We advocate for one day getting higher quality drugs to people, higher purity that's one day regulated, those kind of things.
And to what extent are you seeing within the union the kind of prescription drug users who are moving over to street drugs?
Dr. Dan identified a group of people that are primarily young people who started off with OxyContin or other types of pain meds. Like he said, for one reason or another, they were cut off the pain meds, or the cost got too high, and so there's a group of young people who are new to heroin use, new to IV drug use, relatively, and then we also have a group of older people that have been using heroin and other opiates for a long, long time. Now, that's just one of the groups of people that come to the union. I'd say about 65% are homeless IV heroin users. Another 25% are methamphetamine users, either IV or smoking. And another 15% to 20% are crack users, crack cocaine users. And then there's people who mix all three drugs together and other drugs, including pills. One of the issues I see with the young people, the youth that are using opiates and pills, is that there's a lot of injection of morphine sulfates, continuous release morphine sulfate, which has a lot of binders in the pill form, and that if people have problems like they miss a shot or something, they're very likely to get an abscess. There's all kinds of side effects that come from injecting those types of pills, like pulmonary hypotension. It's a real problem. And we've been advocating for the use of wheel filters, which is a special kind of filter to filter out pills.
Great. Thank you. Laura Thomas from the Drug Policy Alliance, let's go to you next. Can you tell us the type of – a lot of the innovations in San Francisco are things that your organization has advocated for both in San Francisco, around the state, and nationally. Can you talk about some of the key policy issues today that you're currently fighting for?
San Francisco, as Alice said, has been a leader in a lot of harm reduction responses over the years and continues to be a leader. And the overdose prevention efforts, distribution of Narcan is definitely one of them. And San Francisco and the Department of Public Health continues to be at the forefront of making sure that naloxone is getting to people, whether they are pain patients getting prescribed opiates or injection drug users who are using illicit heroin, making sure that clinicians in the health department are prescribing naloxone to them along with their prescriptions. One of the things that we're working on right now from the Drug Policy Alliance, we have a bill that Assemblymember Bloom from Santa Monica has introduced that we're doing with the California Pharmacists Association to try to get better access to naloxone in pharmacies. So that, similar to how Plan B emergency contraception was treated, or flu vaccines, that I could walk into, say, the Walgreens on the corner near my house and walk out with naloxone and a knowledge of how to use it.
How does that work now? What is the current situation?
So right now you need a prescription to get naloxone. So I could go to my doctor and say either, I may be willing to say to my doctor, I'm using illicit drugs, but many people won't for very good reasons, right? Or say to your doctor, I'm concerned about my child who I think is using drugs. Will you give me a prescription of naloxone? And that's legal for a doctor to write it, even if they know you might use it for someone else. Here in San Francisco, the health department has set up these collaborative practice agreements so that I can go to a training with the DOPE Project, and they can train me in how to use naloxone and give me a prescription of it, and they can refill my prescription. And that's done under the umbrella of the health department. But I can't buy it over the counter right now. And ultimately, naloxone needs to be over the counter. It's something everyone should have in their medicine cabinet. It's a safety precaution. People should have better access to it. So that's one of the things we're trying to do, is get pharmacies able to furnish naloxone to someone who needs it.
Now, speaking of over-the-counter, there's another bill carried by Phil Ting from San Francisco about increasing the ability to get syringes without a prescription. And I understand that the former law is about to expire, so it's very time-sensitive here to get this through. Can you explain the situation, what the current situation is, and what Phil Ting's bill would do?
Phil Ting's bill would extend a current program that has been in operation here in San Francisco for many, many years, and it's been in operation around the state for many years. So it's just extending a program that's been in place, that's been evaluated, and that works. So the idea is it's non-prescription pharmacy sales of syringes. California was one of the last states in the country to authorize this. We were number 48. in the country to authorize this sort of pharmacy sales of syringes. So Phil Ting picked this up. The Drug Policy Alliance and the San Francisco AIDS Foundation are co-sponsoring it. And the current program is set to expire at the end of this year, as you said. So this bill will lift that expiration and make it, hopefully, a permanent program.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're discussing heroin and harm reduction with our guests, Laura Thomas of the Drug Policy Alliance, Dr. Daniel Ciccaroni, professor at UCSF, and Johnny Lorenz, needle exchange manager at the San Francisco Drug Users Union. We were joined earlier by Dr. Alice Gleghorn from the San Francisco Department of Public Health. And right now on the line, we have Mary Howe. She is the executive director of Homeless Youth Alliance. Mary, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What are some of the issues you're seeing out on the streets with homeless youth in San Francisco?
That's a loaded question, but a lot. I mean, I think youth end up homeless in San Francisco for a wide variety of reasons. I think San Francisco will always be a place youth come from all over the country looking for some kind of acceptance in a better way. And I think a lot of times youth start out using various kinds of substances and will find themselves using opiates for whatever reason. I know that was a question earlier asked to Dan about what kinds of people use drugs, and I think it's every person, you know. I know for me, I was a young person who came to San Francisco and got strung out on heroin, and my life was saved by naloxone. And I'm so grateful for that, that I got that opportunity to have another chance.
And
so I think a lot of what Homeless Youth Alliance does is really bearing witness to people's experience and helping empower them to make healthier life choices.
And how long have you been the executive director of the organization?
Well, Homeless Youth Alliance was born out of another nonprofit. I've been there since 1999, but Homeless Youth Alliance started in 2006.
And are you seeing different problems on the streets now than when you first came to San Francisco and first started working with the organization?
I mean, yes and no. I think I know there was an earlier reference to the treatment on demand. I still think it's extremely hard for people to get the treatment they want when they want it. I think that's a huge issue. I also think that there's a huge issue of stigma. And when we're talking about drug use and overdose and things like that, the reason people die is because there is a stigma associated with it and because they feel like they cannot be open to their family and their friends about their use. And the majority of people who die from drug overdose do so alone because no one is there to help them.
Dan, let me ask you about the internationally. I want to get a sense of, are there models? I know you mentioned Johnny Vancouver, which a lot of people look at to as a very progressive city doing good work in this area. Are there other models that you've seen around the world that even San Francisco as a model in the United States could look to?
Oh, certainly. I would actually say the United States is far behind some European and Canadian models. There are models that that really take treatment on demand very seriously, where folks can any day of the week access treatment. There are models where syringe access by any means necessary is the norm, through pharmacies, through vending machines, through community-based programs. There are safe injection facilities, and these have been pioneered in Europe and in Vancouver. And there's an enormous body of literature, of scientific literature, showing their success in terms of reducing both public health outcomes, these infections we've been talking about, but also overdose, reducing drug use itself. Paradoxically, when people are treated well and have services that they like, they then ask for the next steps. You know, so moving from safe injection room to how do I get off the drug merry-go-round? There are even heroin prescription programs worldwide. So when other opiate substitution therapies, think methadone and buprenorphine, don't work, there are clinics that are in Germany, for example, that are prescribing, and in Canada, I think there was an experiment up there, prescribing heroin and showing good results clinically at maintaining people and keeping them out of the cycle of street-based drug use.
Johnny, can you comment on that? Is your group familiar with what's happening around the world, and are you advocating for bringing some of these things to San Francisco and to the States?
Well, yes, we're very aware of that. There are over 90 safe injection rooms or drug consumption rooms around the world now, and that there's never been an overdose death in any one of those facilities in all the time that they've been active. And yes, we definitely are advocating for a safe injection facility in San Francisco. I think right now the situation is that people who are homeless especially and need a place to inject a drug that they are physically dependent on are forced to use whatever, you know, be it in public, be it in public parks, in public bathrooms, in between parked cars next to, I got to say it, piles of human feces, because there's also a lack of bathrooms in general for homeless people. And it's a situation that is a health crisis in and of itself. We may have cut down on the spread of HIV and hepatitis C and other bloodborne pathogens by distributing clean syringes, but we haven't taken care of the issue of public nuisance. You know, people don't want to see people inject on the streets. People, drug users themselves, don't want to be seen by children and by other people on the streets injecting, but they're forced to go to those ends to get to what to do what they need to do.
And Laura, what's the Drug Policy Alliance's position on safe injection facilities?
We think safe injection facilities provide a number of health benefits and should be tried here in the United States. We know that supervised injection facilities, as Dan and Johnny just described, address some of the public health and the health harms that can come from injecting drugs. They address the public safety issues. They reduce syringes that are improperly disposed of in the streets. And again, as Dan said, they actually, at least in terms of Insight in Vancouver, the research has shown that people who use Insight are more likely to go to detox and to stop using drugs. So,
can I just say that evaluation was, I mean, they're publishing in all the leading medical journals, you know, around the world. It's not, it's very, it's all peer reviewed and very carefully done.
Yes, yes, exactly. And we think that just as syringe exchange programs and syringe access programs have taken a while to become as accepted as they are in the United States, supervised injection facilities are the next step beyond syringe access programs, and there's really no reason why we're not providing them here in San Francisco and here in the United States.
Why is the United States behind, do you think? There's a sense of morality that comes into American discussions about drug use, where it seems like in Europe and Canada and elsewhere, it's much more seen as an illness, as a public health problem. Why is that?
That's the big question. You know, in the United States, we chose to criminalize drug use, which has driven our prison populations enormously. And we decided to treat drug use and people who use drugs as a criminal justice problem, and have applied criminal justice tools to trying to change a human behavior. And that's not been very effective. We've spent billions and billions and billions of dollars on prosecuting the war on drugs, which has been a war on communities, a war on individuals, a war on families. We have produced worse health outcomes. We've contributed to the spread of HIV and hepatitis. We've lost many, many people to overdose as a result of the criminalizing approach. And from a Drug Policy Alliance perspective, we believe that the public health system and the healthcare system has much better tools for mitigating some of the harms that come from drug use, that the health system is the way to help people change their relationship with drugs and reduce the harms of drugs in their life. And we need to move towards an approach that's based in health, but is also based in just compassion and respect for basic human behavior, such as taking drugs.
And Dan, what would you say about those comments?
Well, I would say that the U.S.'s approach to drug policy is outmoded and ineffective. I know more on the supply side. For example, our interdiction efforts internationally have only led to purer and cheaper heroin over the last 20 years. There's not a lot of evidence that supply side, this war on drugs internationally, has produced anything other than paradoxical results. And from the local level, I think that there's a lot that we can do to improve the health of the population. We do need to shift our attitudes a little bit and trust science. You know, I would say sort of neutrally on the safe injection, the supervised injection facility question, that it might help differently in the U.S., and therefore we would start with a study as opposed to a blanket policy that just opens one up.
Because so you could have a pilot program that's carefully researched.
Yes, because this isn't Canada, you know, and we just don't know how well it will work.
Great. You are listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're discussing heroin and harm reduction with our guests, Laura Thomas of the Drug Policy Alliance, Dr. Daniel Ciccaroni from UCSF, Johnny Lorenz, a needle exchange manager at the San Francisco Drug Users Union. We were joined earlier by Dr. Alice Gleghorn from the San Francisco Department of Public Health. We now invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on klw.org or on our Facebook page. Before we go to our callers, we already have an email coming in that I think is a very important question. And I think, Mary, do we still have you on the line? Mary, are you there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Okay, great. This is a question that I thought would be great for you. One of our listeners emailed in. I was wondering whether any of your guests have delved into the question or know of research on what drives young people, teenagers, towards such serious drug use. In particular, it seems like these days the risks are so much more significant in terms of drug purity and potency. What would you say to our listener who emailed in that question?
I mean, I think that youth are, and it's nothing new, are looking for something better and are looking to feel better. And I think the more and more parents are being self-absorbed and not spending time with their kids, kids will look to outside things. I think the reason people use heroin and other illicit drugs is because it works to provide them with some ease that they're looking for in their lives. And I think that, you know, when we're talking about the criminalization of drugs, you know, we've created this cycle for people, and because there is such a stigma associated with it, we've cut off having a real conversation with our families
about how we're feeling. And so what happens is youth look to outside sources.
And I know you have been challenged recently working with youth because you lost your lease in December for your drop-in center, which is one of the few safe spaces for homeless youth. How are you managing that, and where are the young people going, do you think, who used to come to you?
So now we are also homeless, just like our participants, and we're operating on the street all day long. So from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., we're out on the street working with the same youth. So they haven't gone anywhere. And I think that's, you know, gets into the whole NIMBYism of people think that the services will bring people somewhere. And the reason services exist is because the people are already there. So we have not seen any of the hundreds of homeless youth who congregate in the Haight-Ashbury area where I work leave the neighborhood to find services in other neighborhoods. They've simply stayed there, and their health is decompensating because we do not have a facility to operate out of right now.
Okay, Mary, thanks so much for calling in and joining us. Johnny, I want to ask you, are you finding that the members of your union, because of the pinch on different nonprofits in the city, are finding fewer places to go and more of them are now on the streets because of lack of other options?
Yes, most definitely. I mean, as part of the whole housing and real estate crunch in San Francisco, you're seeing many, many, many long-term nonprofit service organizations who are finding their rents quadrupled and being forced out of their locations by the economic situation in San Francisco, and that's. So there's a ever-increasing demand for the services that are left, you know, and Haya's situation is a real shame that they don't have a place to give services to the youth that are in the Haight. We see the youth that are in the Tenderloin, and there's some crossover there. But in general, it's having a negative impact on the health and safety of people who use drugs in San Francisco.
And as you said, you're located in the Tenderloin. Have you seen NIMBYism there? Are there folks who don't want your union to be where you are, or are the neighbors okay with it?
Well, we've been in our location for about 3 years. We've had an office at 149 Turk Street. And I'd say in general, the neighbors are still getting to know us, but we do things like attend the Tenderloin police station community meetings, and people bring up issues about syringes in front of our needle exchange, and we address them directly, and we talk about the ways in which we make sure that at least in front of our location, there's no needles being left on the street. And we also are doing things like setting up a safety patrol to go out into the communities and help to clean up needles.
Okay, let's go to the phones now. We have David from Sausalito. David, welcome to City Visions.
Thank you. My question is about pharmaceutical painkillers as gateway drugs to heroin use and what the panel sees as reasonable policy changes in the administration of pharmaceutical drugs to prevent them from becoming gateway drugs to heroin use.
Okay, Dan, let's let you start with that.
Thanks for your question, David. You know, medicine as an organized practice is reeling from this right now. There's lots of conversations about what went wrong, what we could do better in terms of the management of chronic pain. Some of the clever suggestions that I've heard, one is to address the problem, right? Some people say, well, we'll just stop prescribing opiate pain pills and then turn a blind eye to the consequences. Well, that's obviously not a very good policy or medical practice. My friend, Dr. Philip Coffin from the Department of Public Health has proposed that we take stewardship of the issue and that we look at how we manage someone who's highly dependent on pain pills and to transition them over to something that's safer and better for them, as opposed to just cutting them off and saying good luck. How to address honestly, openly the issue of comorbidities, if you will, dependency on pain pills and their existing chronic pain. And there's some strategies, you know, prescription of naloxone. Naloxone is both good for pain and good for opiate dependency. There's the approach toward mental health. Some people are chronically depressed or have other mental health issues that need to be addressed in order to get off of chronic pain management. So I appreciate the caller's question. I think lots of discussion going on, lots of high-level conference and policy debates going on as far as where do we go from here. I think the consensus is that we have overdone it on the prescription of opiate pain pills and that we need to be more clever and savvy about whom to give them to and whom to prescribe them to, for what length of time, and what to do when that individual triggers a genetic thing in their body that says, oh, I like these too much. I'm getting, you know, in over my head. How do we best manage that person?
And are these policy debates or something that the Drug Policy Alliance is involved in?
Yes, definitely. One comment I wanted to add to that is it's not necessarily the prescribing of prescription opiates that are leading people to heroin as much as when they stop prescribing prescription opiates without giving people another alternative.
Right.
So that's where better pain management techniques and treatment such as methadone or buprenorphine, if people need to come off of their opiates, need to be options. That it's not necessarily that if you are given a prescription of OxyContin, you're inevitably going to be trying heroin in a year. It's when those prescription practices change, and I agree that they probably need to change. But when we put in place punitive responses that either come down on the prescriber or come down on the individual, that's often where people turn to a black market option. We can do a better job that is not criminalizing the doctors, that is not criminalizing the individual, that's providing them with other better pain management and substance use treatment options.
Because it seems like we almost went from one extreme to the other, where we were way too we let way too many of these drugs get to way too many people. But now the opposite reaction is cutting people off, and it's driving people who then suddenly have this addiction looking else where else they can go, and they're suddenly getting into things they might not otherwise get in. Dan?
Well, just another quick comment. I also want to be careful not to just blame the medical profession. I think there was a lot of
the doctor of the group, of course, right, standing up.
Yes. You know, there was also the advertising and the promotion by the pharmaceutical industry. I don't want to mention any drug in particular, but they've been incredibly hyped up. And they're also coming out, some of the versions of these pain pills are coming out in very strong formulas. And there's a lot of attention that needs to be paid to that as well.
You are listening to City Visions on local public radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, the topic is heroin and harm reduction. We're joined by Laura Thomas of the Drug Policy Alliance, Dr. Daniel Ciccaroni from UCSF, and Johnny Lorenz from the San Francisco Drug Users Union. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Our number, again, is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on the KLW website or our Facebook page. Let's go back to the phones, and we have Mary from Oceano on the phone. Mary, welcome to City Visions.
Thank you. I have to say I really appreciate your show tonight. It's a discussion that warrants more than an hour, but thank you very much. You know, there was two things that I would like the panel to address, since you have such a broad range of experts. Is one, I think the general public needs to know what fentanyl is, and I have been using fentanyl, you know, for almost 15 years now, and have yet to regress back to heroin. But I don't use it for the same reasons. And secondly is that, you know, the whole topic when you start mixing medical treatment in with, you know, drug use and the illegal effects and the, you know, the punitive aspects of it all, which is horrific in itself. you start to drive people who truly need pain management out of the system. It makes it harder for people such as the people who work in the mines who have black lung disease, where this kind of started from because economically they couldn't afford to live and unfortunately had to sell some of their pain medication, and it started this snowball effects of attention. But it's caused it very hard on people to get health care in good pain management systems. And I consider myself very fortunate because the man I work with is not only a pain management specialist, but also a psychiatrist. So he's able to pick up different things, but not all people have access to that kind of care. So back to the panel is, please explain to them what fentanyl is and how dangerous it can be if it's not used properly, and what it's doing to people who truly do belong in pain management.
Thank you for your question, Mary. Dr. Dan, you want to take that one?
Sure. Thank you for your question. So fentanyl is one of the most powerful synthetic opiates that science has created. It's a wonderful pain medicine. It's particularly useful in the management of acute pain, where you have somebody who you're concerned about getting them out of pain, but having an opiate that lasts too long because it's incredibly short-acting. So very powerful and short-acting. So it's very useful in the emergency room setting. It's also useful in the chronic pain setting because it comes in patches, and the patches can be worn on the skin, so you're not taking pills all the time. There's a steady release of medication. Now, if misused, it's incredibly dangerous. And there is, for example, fentanyl-laced heroin floating around the country, particularly in the Midwest and Northeast. It's highly toxic, causes a lot of overdose, particularly among the uninitiated. So there's a lot of concern about that as well. As far as Mary's questions about pain management, I completely agree. I'm very concerned that the pendulum is going to swing from over-prescribing to under-prescribing, and we're going to leave a whole generation of people in pain. What I'll say there is two things. One is that pain, treatment of pain, the easy solution is using the pills. The hard solution is a comprehensive approach to pain management. We know it works. It's under-resourced. It's underutilized. It's hard to get into sometimes because it's under-resourced. But comprehensive pain management is a solution. And the pills are often used because they're easy, they're quick. General practitioners, family doctors such as myself have that tool to use. But we need to be careful about always taking the easy route.
We have an email now, Sean from Oakland. Why do we only start talking about drug use when famous white people die? Who wants to take this one? Johnny.
So why do we only talk about drug use when famous white people die? I mean, that's a question that speaks to the history of this country and the history of drug laws in this country and the history of the drug laws that were originally started in the 20s were racist laws. They were directed at African Americans and Chinese people, and it's been a theme ever since. And that's part of the reason, you know, and it's only because we just don't pay attention when people of color and other oppressed people die of drug overdoses. It's much more, it hits home to the people that are the rulers of the society, which is, you know, white people.
Laura, what are the racial disparities in the war on drugs that your organization has looked at?
Well, it's what Johnny said, that the war on drugs has operated as a war on communities of color. Here in San Francisco, we have the honor of having passed the very first laws criminalizing the consumption of a substance. And it was targeting the Chinese who were smoking opium during a particularly racist and xenophobic time in San Francisco's history. And what was made illegal was the smoking of opium, which is what the Chinese folks in the Chinese community were doing. What was not made illegal were the not even prescription opiates, but the opiates that anyone could buy at their corner store or pharmacy.
So a real parallel to crack cocaine versus powder cocaine all these years later.
Yes, exactly. So the opiates that white grandmothers were purchasing at the store was not criminalized. The smoking of opium, which had a particular cultural resonance to it and was done by the Chinese, who were particularly marginalized and stigmatized at that time. So it was a law that was about racial control. And that's been the history of the war on drugs ever since, is that the laws we pass are by and large laws about racial control. The drugs that are legal versus the drugs that are not legal are primarily determined by who it was assumed were using them. The drugs that marginalized communities, the drugs that communities of color were perceived to be using, were made illegal. The other drugs continue to be legal now.
Dan, do you have a comment on that?
I think Philip Seymour Hoffman's death is really sad and unfortunate event. He was a wonderful actor and a real loss to our culture. That said, he's typical. I mean, there's a lot of folks that are transitioning from pills, which he did, to heroin. The heroin is stronger and purer these days. There's new forms that are particularly dangerous that are hitting the streets now. And I think we need to focus on the population level and the thousands of folks across the country that are at risk of these new strong forms of heroin.
And I think the issue is any death is a great tragedy, but why is it that certain deaths seem to get a lot more attention than everyday deaths that are happening on our streets that go relatively unnoticed by most of the community? And, I want to turn to, we just have a few minutes left, something we haven't been able to get to, which are Good Samaritan laws, which I think is really interesting, because the idea is that if someone is overdosing and you call 911, that people are scared to call 911 because they have been using together and they do not, back to the criminalization, they do not want to be thrown behind bars, and people are needlessly dying because people are scared to call in for help. Can you talk about, from a policy perspective, Laura, how that has been addressed?
Yeah, and this is one of the areas where research and the voices of drug users have informed our policy proposals. So we know that the main reason people don't call 911 when they witness an overdose is that they're afraid of being arrested. They're afraid that the person who's overdosing will be arrested. And so the 911 Good Samaritan laws try to change the incentives in that situation so that people can do the right thing without criminal penalties. So it provides the law that's in effect here in California, provides some limited immunity from drug possession or paraphernalia possession charges for the person who calls 911 and for the individual who's suffering the overdose, so that they can access emergency health services and live instead of potentially dying or getting arrested.
Johnny, do laws like this change the behavior of drug users in that situation where they see a friend in trouble?
Yes and no. Because it's the history, once again, has been that people who do call 911 to report an overdose, there's just too many stories of people who were then arrested, the people who called, the people who were around at the time, people being prosecuted for murder charges at times for having called 911 to report an overdose. Getting the message to our members that the law has changed has been difficult, and we need to do as much promotion of the fact that these laws have changed as possible, because the history has been just too long of people suffering severe consequences when they've called to report an overdose. I mean, that is part of why Narcan is so successful, because if people get really skilled at using it, they don't have to call 911. Not that they shouldn't call 911, but people who are, you know, in the...
You understand the mistrust that people
yes,
have.
Yes, yes. Right. It's deep.
Okay, we have time for one very quick call. Laura from San Francisco, welcome to City Visions. What is your quick comment or question?
Hi, everybody. You guys are fabulous. This is Douglas Mann. And my question is, how does the recent research and conversations around using medical marijuana to treat pain could be debated in the harm reduction community, in the medical community, as a way to transition from pain meds to using something like CBD and cannabis that is showing to be so successful to manage pain?
Okay, I want to let each of you quickly answer that, but we are short on time. So just a quick, concise answer from each of you. Let's start with you, Laura.
So the research is showing that this is one of the reasons why people are using medical cannabis is to transition off of prescribed pain medicine. My colleague, Dr. Amanda Ryman, has done a study looking at this at the Berkeley Patients Group and found that this was a very common reason why people wanted to use medical cannabis, because they could address their pain without the side effects of prescription opioids.
Dan?
I like the comment about the different strains and varieties of medical marijuana that are useful for different types of patients. So you can, for example, get relief of pain without getting the cognitive side effects and memory and the focus issues. So I think medicine should start to do more studies and get more involved in the medical marijuana prescription.
Johnny.
In my career as a drug or substance use counselor, I saw great success with people who I could, in a state where marijuana is legal, medical marijuana is legal, using cannabis substitution strategies, where people would reduce their use of a more harmful drug and increase their use of medical marijuana. And people have been able to reduce their use of all kinds of things, cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, anything, alcohol especially. And it's a very successful strategy for reducing people's use of other drugs.
Okay. Well, thank you all so much for joining us this evening. That is City Visions. Our guest tonight, again, Laura Thomas from the Drug Policy Alliance, Daniel Ciccaroni, professor at UCSF, Johnny Lorenz, needle exchange manager at the San Francisco Drug Users Union, and earlier we were joined by Dr. Alice Glickhorn from the San Francisco Department of Public Health, and we also had Mary call in from the Homeless Youth Organization, which we really appreciated. That's Mary Howe, the executive director of the Homeless Youth Alliance. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was Kevin Vance. Tonight's show was produced by Lisa Denenmark. Join my co-host, Joseph Pache, next Monday as we discuss the college admissions process. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.